Well, I wanted to start talking about the strike by sort of painting a bit of a picture of the East End of London at the time, which was where the factories were based. So Engels described the East End of London in 1885 as an ever-spreading pool of stagnant misery and desolation, of starvation when out of work and degradation, physical and moral, when in work. So the East End was a concentration of the most oppressed workers in London. There were really large numbers of immigrants, especially Irish, and later a lot of Jews fleeing pogroms in Russia and across Europe. It was the home of sweated labour, so that was defined as our work for below substance wages, excessively long working hours, and an insanitary state of the houses in which work is carried out. So the work was extremely casualised to keep wages down and workers desperate. So to give you guys a bit of a sense of that, to get a day's work at the docks, men would gather in their thousands at the dock gates. The foreman would choose who had work, and the men would climb on the backs of the others to lift themselves higher and get the attention of foremen. So it was a pretty desperate situation. Reports from the East, the East End captivated polite society and fueled moral panic. So the new factories were portrayed as dens of vice, female workers as sexually promiscuous, and the mixed gender nature of many workplaces and the fact that women engaged in hot or dirty work were inevitably or not formally or even fully dressed was emphasised. So there's a whole bunch of interesting illustrations from the time that are kind of used to like shock and titillate the middle classes. Economic recession from 1873 alongside increasing international competition from unified Germany and the US saw an overall national decline in wages in Britain from 1874 to 1887, with sweated workers being hit particularly hard. Sections of the upper classes were becoming increasingly concerned with the poverty of the East End by the early 1880s, with charity work in the East becoming quite the proper thing to do for the London middle classes and a government inquiry into sweated work. From 1883, the press was full of dire warnings of imminent revolt, and the Pall Mall Gazette warned that extreme inequality was a great danger to the Commonwealth. So these concerns were fueled by the growing discontent of workers and the poor, who were increasingly critical of the two-party system and of the Liberal Party. So while the trade unions were generally conservative, tailed the Liberal Party, and typically only organised skilled workers, workers began to get involved in politics in new forums. So a number of socialist groups formed in the 1880s, including the Social Democratic Federation and Fabian Socialists, which organised open-air meetings and protests against unemployment, for Irish rights and for free speech. Banning protests and police violence only served to encourage unity in defiance of the bans and help to politicise people. So one of the most famous demonstrations in this is the Bloody Sunday that took place in 1887. So the three-week match girl strike of 1888 pushed this rebellion into the workplace and sparked a wave of strikes and of unionisation of unskilled workers. And the decisive victory of the match girls inspired workers to follow in their lead. So the match workers epitomised the impoverishment and oppression of the East End. Match factories were the largest casual employer of women and girls in the East End. And according to Brian and May, the bosses in the factory, the workforce was almost entirely Irish. So the way that matches were produced in the Brian and May factories were extremely dangerous. So to give you a bit of a sense of it, matches were actually produced by firstly slicing the wood into small pieces, which would eventually sort of become two matches. These were then heated on an iron plate and dried. Then they were attached to frames with machines and then dipped into phosphorus paste. Then they were removed from the frames, cut into single matches and boxed. So the phosphorus paste that they were dipped into was with toxic white phosphorus. So ingestion of just a small amount of white phosphorus caused nausea and vomiting. And Louise Raw, who I'll talk about a bit later, she wrote a really fabulous book on the strike. But part of her book was that she tracked down like grandchildren of people involved in the the strike, and so it was kind of a family tale being passed down of like piles of fluorescent vomit, like leading from the homes to the factories. So I'll show you what the sort of effects of full-blown like phosphorus poisoning looks like in the next slide. So this was kind of casually known as Fossey Jaw. The second one's from a TV show, but that's kind of what it looked like. So you can see the jaw is pretty much entirely, collapsed there. So it sort of starts with a small toothache and influenza-like symptoms, yellowing of the skin and some swelling out of the face and pain in the lower and sometimes upper jaw. And then there's the development of putrid abscesses, which produce pus. And that's said to make it difficult even for loved ones to remain in their presence. And disfigurement and even painful death resulted with inflammation of the brain resulting in convulsion and hemorrhaging from the lungs. And the number of deaths from phosphorus poisoning are hard to calculate since the compulsory notification of these kinds of deaths were actually like only started in 1895, and even after that there was still cases of them not reporting the deaths. From phosphorus poisoning. So it was the process of dipping the matches into the phosphorus paste, that involved the most risk of phosphorus poisoning, and that was most commonly done by male workers. But given that the factories were so poorly ventilated, it was really a danger to everyone. And in particular, since workers didn't actually have separate break rooms or anything, workers ate in the rooms in which they worked. So this was described in a famous article by Annie Besant, which I'll talk about later, as fumes from the phosphorus mix with their poor meal, and they eat disease as seasoning to their bread. So workers were forced to work at breakneck speed, which combined with the use of heavy machinery meant that workers frequently lost fingers. And Brian and May workers also faced a number of punitive deductions in their pay, including for things like having dirty feet, any matches that set alight during production, talking, and in one case that I read about, of slowing down production just slightly so as to prevent someone's fingers from being pulled off. So these deductions were enforced by abusive foremen who were regularly hit the workers. And Brian and May also employed many children. They considered 8 to be the perfect age to begin work. But by 1871, there was legislation that made it compulsory, tragically for Brian and May, for children between the age of 5 and 10 to attend school at least half time. And they publicly complained about this and sort of tried to, there were certainly loopholes that they would try and use to still employ children between the ages of 5 to 10. And the days were really long, starting at 6:30 a.m. in the summer and 8 a.m. in winter, and finishing up at 6 p.m. So for these long hours and horrific conditions subject to deductions, workers were typically paid around 4 shillings a week, with the highest workers being paid about, 13 shillings, but sort of regarded with awe by the rest of the workforce. Okay, so some of these conditions were criticised at a Fabian socialist meeting on June 15, 1887, which voted to boycott on Bryant and May factories. So after attending this meeting, Annie Besant interviewed 3 workers outside Bryant and May factories on Fairfield Road and published an expose of the horrific conditions and pay based on their comments in her paper, The Link. So that was on June 23. And her account accuses Brian and May of breaking multiple laws, details the conditions of work, and goes through some of the fines and dismal pay that I just went through before. So that is Annie Besant there, and that will give you a sense of sort of the tone of the article. It's a very strong moral condemnation of the situation. And the article is usually described as part of Annie Besant's strategy to organise the Match Girls strike. But this narrative is really thoroughly debunked by Louise Rohr, who I mentioned before. So she's a social historian who actually really wanted to look in detail at the strike, because it was usually told as, you know, this Fabian socialist who managed to organise a three-week strike in a, like, area of work that was considered unorganisable. So she was kind of looking to see some of the tactics that, you know, meant that she could pull this off. But what she actually found is that Annie Besant didn't lead the strike. That as a Fabian socialist at the time, she didn't think that strikes were a good strategy for improving the women's conditions. She actually wrote in the same copy of The Link that organising a union or leading a strike with the girls of Brian and May was impossible, as they would be sacked and easily replaced. And she argued that trade unionism might teach comradeship and stir up social feeling, improve their business faculty and brighten their lives in many ways, but it would not raise their wages. Yeah, so the Louise Rohr's book on that's called Striking a Light, it explores the strike in a far greater detail, proving that Annie Besant didn't know that the workers were on strike until a few days into the action, and instead argues that the leaders of the strike were among the workers themselves, who were becoming politicised by the growing inequality and by the presence of socialist movements and protest movements that are a part of life in the East End of London. Yeah, so if people want to read more on the strike, that's really the book to get. So Annie Besant's intention in publishing the article was to goad Brian and May to take her to court for libel, for creating to create a bit of a public commotion around this. So Besant had actually used this strategy previously to promote other issues. The second thing that she intended was to promote a consumer boycott of Brian and May, which the Fabian socialists had started, and thirdly, to pressure the shareholders of Brian and May, which included many sort of liberal public figures of clergymen, liberal MPs and prominent feminists. So she portrays the matchwomen as helpless, uncomplaining of their exploitation, sort of as per the factory girl trope, in order to elicit sympathy from consumers and stakeholders rather than orienting to the girls themselves. But the article does set off a whole train of events which pushes the women to strike. So in late June, foremen at Brian and May attempted to force workers to sign papers refuting the conditions and pay that Besant revealed in The Link. So the workers refused to sign this. The foremen then targeted three women that they suspected of speaking to Besant by giving them very little work. And the following week, the foremen increased this pressure and made an example of one woman, who continued to refuse to sign the statement, and she was dismissed for her defiance. And so a match worker describes what happens at the time next. She says, "It just went like Tinder. One girl began, and the rest said yes, so out we all went." So the women from the Victoria building walked out immediately on the morning of July 2nd, and they stayed at the gates until the lunch break to convince the other sites to join them. Brian and May had clearly not bargained for this mass rebellion. They immediately offered to reinstate the sacked woman, but it was too late. And the East London Observer at the time writes that the spirit of revolt against cruel oppression has been aroused. And the women immediately widened their demands and declared that they would not go back to work until their other conditions were met as well. This one's from the East London Advertiser. So despite not supporting the woman and the strike, they still talk about how vibrant the whole thing was. Of 1,500 women, once outside, made noisy display for a little while. And matchwomen told the Star that they had selected six representatives consisting entirely of matchwomen to meet with the company directors on the first day of the strike. Reports in the Star show that the women organised a lively and well-attended picket line by 8 a.m. on the second day of the strike. Bryant reported that he spoke of the pickets in the East London Advertiser, saying that they were sure that they would have full assistance from the police to break through the picket line and get scabs through. But there's really nothing to indicate that the police managed to get any scabs through. I've only managed to find a report of two scabs being severely beaten by several women, and the Star reported that the whole factory was lying idle by July 6. And later on in the strike, Brian and May actually threatened to import scabs from Glasgow to replace the strikers, And one of the socialist groups at the time, the SDF, responded by organising a protest in Glasgow in support of the strike. Yeah, but this was never acted upon, so it seems like there was very little scabbing during the strike. Okay, so the typical story of the strike presents Annie Besant as organising the strike and its meetings, fundraising, and so forth. And so while it's true that Annie Besant, alongside other members of the Fabian Socialists and Social Democratic Federation, helped to distribute the strike funds, speak at meetings, and organise solidarity, pickets, marches, lists of demands, and meetings with management had all occurred before Annie Besant found out about the strike, which she found out about on July 6th when 100 match workers marched to her office in London to see how she could support the strike. So while Brian and May attempted to pin the strike on outside agitators, which this article does as well, claiming that relations with the workforce had always been good until socialist interference upset their mind, and right-wing newspapers such as The Times attributed the strike to those pests of the modern world, the socialists. The company records show a list of five troublemakers that they considered would be the most likely to lead the strike. And that's not to say that the socialists had no impact on the ideas of the workers. Match workers imply that they'd recognised Annie Besant from socialist platforms, so they would have attended socialist meetings or rallies in the East End as part of the wave of politicisation. And the socialist organisations were able to use their networks to build support, you know, speak at rallies and use their newspapers to gather strike funds. So they did play an important role. It's just not the sort of overblown role of Annie Besant as the sort of socialist hero sweeping in. This is an image of the strike committee that would have been taken after sort of distributing the strike funds. So there's Annie Besant and Herbert Burrows in the middle, and then everyone else is workers at the match factory. Okay, so the match workers organised frequent marches and mass meetings. The Star reported a meeting of thousands of people on July 9, where several workers gave speeches detailing the conditions and in the factory and their reasons for striking. And Annie Besant spoke at that meeting as well. Many of the marches are described as causing a massive commotion and bringing cabs and buses to a standstill simply because of the novelty of such poor people appearing in procession outside the East End. And another description of a march of match women outlines a song sung by the workers to the tune of what most people here probably know as Solidarity Forever, which repeats the line, "We'll hang old Bryant from on the sour apple tree," which is a reference to an old Welsh punishment. So when the workers weren't satisfied with just the reinstatement of the sacked worker, Brian May attempted to wage a public debate that the women workers were treated actually very well, and that it was within the law, and that this was just sort of a matter of the socialists poisoning their minds. And much of this debate took place in the Star newspaper, in which Annie Besant sort of continually goads Brian May to take her to court for libel, if they thought that the claims were false. The strike shattered the carefully moulded reputation of Brian and May as a fair and trusted brand associated with British national confidence. Because they did actually have that reputation before the strike, which is kind of astounding when you read the conditions, but that was kind of their reputation. A few Liberal MPs met with a deputation of match women, donated to the match workers, raised questions about the treatment of match girls in Parliament, and spoke at meetings of the striking workers, all of which was particularly embarrassing for Brian and May, given their courting of the Liberal Party. So to give you a bit of a sense of the courtship, Wilberforce Bryant was known to frequently entertain Liberal MPs in his Stoke Park estate, and Theodore Bryant actually commissioned a statue of William Gladstone in 1882 when he was the Prime Minister, and this was actually paid for by deducting a shilling from each worker's pay, and the company enforced an unpaid half-day holiday for the workers to watch its unveiling, at which the workers threw stones at the statue, shouted that they paid for it, and some even cut their arms and trickled blood on the statue to sort of say that they paid for the statue in their blood. But despite all of that, it was still like, you know, the Brian and May were sort of closely associated with the Liberal Party and being sort of a fair company. Okay, so an independent investigation published in the Times found that Besant's original allegations were in fact correct. And Brian and May admitted to the punitive deductions from pay. So having been forced to publicly admit faults while the striking women showed no signs of weakness with massive public support, a serious strike fund, the company's directors finally met with a deputation of match women and members of the London Trades Council on the 16th of July. And the involvement of the London Trades Council was actually pretty unprecedented. So despite being a fairly conservative organisation which generally shunned unskilled workers, they agreed to help the match girls, spoke at rallies, and they even proposed a levy of all affiliated trade unionists if the strike continued. Their involvement and support, I think, is largely due to the widespread support of the workers and their desire not to be cut out of workers' struggle. Following the strike, the London Trades Council generally resisted the turn to mass unions of unskilled workers. So after a prolonged discussion of all parties agreed to the terms which were put to and accepted by a full meeting of strikers, which included the abolition of all fees, abolition of a series of pay deductions, a separate meal room for the workers, and the formation of a union, among other improvements. And the Union of Women Match Workers were formed with Annie Besant as secretary, and this was later renamed to cover both male and female workers. I just want to quote from William Morris's socialist paper, which celebrated the victory of the match girls' strike. And he wrote that even people in such a wretched condition as these poor match girls can make themselves felt temporarily and can help to swell the mass opposition to the manufacturer's ideal, to wit. Human machinery will give not more but less trouble than machinery of mere dead matter. Okay, so the victory of the match girls inspired a wave of strikes and unionisation of unskilled workers, and Engels called it the small push that was needed for the whole avalanche to move. Workers as far as dairy were inspired by the strike, where women shirt makers were successful in pushing the Dairy Trades Council to admit women and unskilled workers as members with the help of Eleanor Marx. Strike victories of unskilled gas workers and tram workers added to the growing sense, in the words of a striking dock worker, that if the working classes hold together, they can do what they like. The dock workers were the key section inspired by the strike, I think. They were very closely linked to the match workers, highly casualised, very Irish, and living near, socialising with, and often marrying match workers. And the match factories and docks were each the largest casual employer of male and female work in the East End at the time. So immediately after the match girls' strike, dockers contacted the Union of Women Match Workers and asked for their advice on establishing their own organisation. And when they struck in October, Annie Besant spoke to 5,000 workers. In 1889, the great dock strike continually drew on the match girls' strike for inspiration, with descriptions of John Burns addressing a mass meeting and saying that the match girls had formed a union and got what they wanted, and so had the gas stokers at Beckton, and surely the dock labourers could do the same. Okay. The strike brought tens of thousands of workers out in solidarity, including match workers, actually, according to the East London Observer. So before the strike upsurge of 1888, union membership sat at 750,000 in Britain. By 1889, it had grown to 860,000, and by 1890, it was just under 2 million. And the increase in strikes and union membership is significant for two key reasons. First, it shattered the assumption that unskilled and semi-skilled men and women workers were unorganisable, since they lacked the bargaining power of craftsmen, which had been dominant but not entirely unchallenged in the workers' movement since the collapse of the Chartist movement in 1848. And given the concentration of women workers in unskilled trades, this also meant that women became a more significant part of the organised working class. So at the time of the match girls' strike, there was less than 50,000 women trade union members, but this was to double in the next 5 years, and many trade union organisations ditched restrictions to women, such as the London Trades Council, which admitted female delegates for the first time in 1890. Secondly, these new trade unions turned to direct action, mass pickets, and physical resistance to scabbing, rather than the previously preferred tactics of conciliation and negotiation. This turn was bitterly opposed by the old union leaders, including George Shipton of the London Trades Council and Henry Broadhurst of the London Union Congress. So Shipton argued that when the people were unenfranchised, were without votes, the only power left to them was the demonstration of numbers. Now, however, the workmen have votes, and he said that the new trade unionists look to governments and legislation, whereas only the old look to self-reliance. Key socialists and leaders in the new unionism wave, Ben Teller and Tom Mann, replied to this to stress the importance of workers' self-organisation as the key to progress. And they said, the statement that the new trade unionists look to government and legislation is bunkum. The key note is to organise first and take action. This approach to mass direct action didn't last, so an offensive from the bosses involving lockouts, union smashing and reversing the 8-hour day started in late 1889, escalating to the defeat of the mostly female workforce at the Manton Mill in Bradford in 1890, and then culminating in the lockout of skilled engineers, first in London, then nationally. And between 1890 and 1892, the membership of the new unions fell from 320,000 to 130,000. And the gas workers, which was one of the most politically advanced unions, dropped from 60,000 in 1890 to 24,000 in 1896. So the political period of class struggle and defeat meant that workers drew sharp conclusions about the realities of class society, while still lacking the confidence to escalate their action in response to the employers' offensive. This contradiction between the rise of political class consciousness and the decline of industrial militancy resolved in a shift of workers' consciousness towards a strategy of labour representation in the form of the Independent Labour Party, which formed in 1893. Strike figures in these years show a consistent fall, a trend that continued into the early years of the 20th century. Collective bargaining on the employer's term was becoming the norm. And this counter-offensive was cemented by two legal decisions, one in 1896, which outlawed picketing, and the notorious Taft-Fail ruling of 1901, which allowed employers to sue unions for losses resulting from strike action. However, the advances of new unionism would never completely reverse the changes. So the changes it brought to the concept of trade unionism would remain. The strike wave and union growth starting in 1888 would lay the basis for future upsurges in trade union militancy from 1909. And despite the ebb, female membership of all trade unions increased from about 37,000 in 1886 to nearly 118,000 in 1896, and then 167,000 in 1906. The decline in the number of strikes was actually celebrated by the Fabian socialists, including Annie Besant. So after the Match Women strike, Annie Besant published a book on the trade union movement, which doesn't mention the Match Women, and praises new unionism on the basis that when it desires change, it will use the ballot box instead of the strike, and will control women workers and unskilled labourers, the two unorganised mobs which have hung around the disciplined army of unionists and have lost them many a fight. Unions were hampered by the growing ranks of cheap and unorganised labour. Other socialist groups such as the Socialist League and the Social Democratic Federation were based around revolutionary politics rather than bureaucratic reformist politics of the Fabians. The Social Democratic Federation, from which the Fabian Socialists and Socialist League split from, was, however, extremely sectarian and dismissive of trade union struggle. And Tom Mann, for instance, resigned from the SDF when they refused to support the campaign for the 8-hour day initially. So although individual socialists such as Eleanor Marx and Tom Mann played a really important role in the wave of new unionism. No socialist organisation massively grew out of the strike wave, and Cahir Decatur needed to withstand the ruling class offensive that followed. So just to conclude, the match workers brought back the politics of mass organisation and direct action of workers. While the trade union officialdom only organised a small section of the working class and tailed the Liberal Party, the match workers inspired tens of thousands of workers to join or form unions and to go on strike. So while the match girls' strike is often remembered through the lens of Annie Besant and the moral concern of middle-class opinion, it was actually the politics of class struggle and class organisation that won improvements for not only the match workers, but the thousands of workers which the match workers were able to prove to that unions of unskilled workers could be formed and that strikes could win. So in the words of Tom Mann, the first considerable movement of new unionism came from the women and girls employed at Brian and May Match Factory. Kindly disposed persons had written about the awful conditions under which the girls worked. Lists of shareholders were published, showing that a considerable percentage of those were clergymen. But nothing brought about any change for the better until the women and girls went on strike.